Welcome to Earth Matters, environmental and social justice stories from around Australia and beyond. This episode is produced at the studios of 3CR in Naarm, Melbourne, on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Earth Matters is distributed nationally through the Community Radio Network. I'd like to pay my respects to elders, past and present, and extend that respect to other First Nations Australians who may be listening to this broadcast. I'm your host, Claudia Craig. Welcome to another episode of Earth Matters.
By armouring a creek with concrete, rocks in concrete, you are essentially putting your grandmother in a straitjacket. And as First Nations people, we can't do that. That's disrespectful.
Australia's First Peoples looked after the country's waterscapes for millennia, before colonisation brought Western ways to water management and excluded their contribution. This week on Earth Matters, we learn what this has meant for Australia's water and how education about Indigenous ways of knowing offers the opportunity to do things differently. I'll be speaking to Wurundjeri scholar Kate Harridan about water and water management in Australia. Kate's an Indigenous water expert working at the Monash Sustainable Development Institute. She speaks to us today from Ngunnawal country in the ACT. I asked Kate to tell us what water means to her.
Yudamurang. G'day, Claudia. Thanks so much for having me. So my name's Kate. I'm a Wurundjeri woman and I'm currently employed by Monash University to look at Indigenous water and what we can do better about it. Wurundjeri Mulgar freshwater people, it's one of the things that we are. So I always find that a tricky thing to answer, what is it about water, because it's sort of everything about water. I guess its foundation, First Nations people tend to believe that water has life, which is a bit different to many non-Indigenous people's belief about water. So I guess that's something I should share with people, is that I do believe that water has life and we have to respond to and respect water's rights, responsibilities and obligations. I grew up on Enoga Creek in Brisbane and, you know, lots of kids, when they finished high school, went down to the Gold Coast or up to the Sunshine Coast for schoolies week, and I played in the local creek. So I do have a special thing for creeks, but I guess part of my concern might be not quite the right word that I have for creeks is the impact of stormwater and stormwater infrastructure. And there was a seminal moment when I was a young person where stormwater infrastructure was introduced to my local creek and totally ruined my favourite swimming spot. Over a period of time, it didn't, on the first flush, didn't kill it, but over a period of time it did. And I guess that's kind of like a bit of a scarring experience for me. I don't have much time for the stormwater concept or the stormwater infrastructure because they just do so much damage. It just does so much damage to streams and creeks.
Well, we'll talk about those impacts a little later. You've talked about the relationship that First Peoples have with water, that water is a living being.
Yep.
Can you expand on that and share a little bit more about the relationship and the ways that water has and is valued by Indigenous communities in Australia?
It's difficult to speak for obviously all Indigenous communities. So most of the examples I'll give will really be Wurundjeri or my own personal experiences. But yes, certainly water is considered a living entity. The Matawa Fitzroy River in the northwest of Australia is, Professor Anne Polina talks about that as an ancestral person, in the sense that rivers have characteristics and responsibilities and rights like a person does. They're not the same rights, because rivers and people clearly aren't the same, but are the same in the sense that we're all sentient beings with equal place and space on and as part of country. And I think a good example of the relationship that Wurundjeri people have with water is, so we're people of the three rivers, and one of the rivers is Murrumbidgee, which some people may know better as the Murrumbidgee, but Murrumbidgee in Wiradjuri translates to good friend. So mara, maram is good, bidji, bidja is friend. I mean, what better way is there to indicate your relationship with the stream, with the creek, with sorry, with the river, that other than to call it good friend? And when it's in flood, it's called big boss. And yet you think about something like Sullivan's Creek in Canberra, where I live. Sullivan's is named after, the creek is named after a Sullivan, a human being, and it's not named for who and what it does in relationship with country and people.
Well, I think that's a very good entry point to the next question I have. Most Australians will be familiar with the British colonial term terra nullius, meaning land belonging to no one, which was, of course, overturned in the landmark Mabo case in 1992. Aqua nullius might be a little more unfamiliar. What did this concept of aqua nullius do? What impacts has it had on Indigenous communities, and can you spell it out to our listeners?
I describe aqua nullius as the systemic and deliberate exclusion of First Nations water rights, science, and governance from contemporary water rights, science, and governance. The idea was so it's always been in existence, but it wasn't really given a name until the last 15 or so years. And the person who's done the most work on developing this concept, and particularly from a legal perspective, is Dr. Virginia Marshall, who was one of my PhD supervisors. She's a Wiradjuri Nyemba woman, still a practicing lawyer, works on native title cases and stuff. Her PhD, probably better off reading the book. The PhD is hardcore, deep legal ease. Her book, Aqua Nullius, really spells out how, from colonial times through to very recent nation state times, laws and policies have shaped the water system we have that excludes Indigenous peoples, and that's what Virginia calls aqua nullius. So I strongly encourage you to go back to the seminal text, which is Virginia Marshall's Aqua Nullius book. There's a chapter in there, I've forgotten what number, that talks really beautifully about First Nations ontology, but ways of believing about water, and in the context of ownership. Non-Indigenous laws about water are about ownership. Who owns it, when, where, why? Indigenous governance about water is not about ownership, it's about custodianship. And again, this is a reflection of the very different ontologies. And Virginia does a lovely bit of work in that chapter, I want to say chapter four, but please don't quote me on that, of her book to really draw out those differences in a legal sense between ownership and custodianship. Strongly encourage those who are interested to find Virginia Marshall's work.
You're listening to Earth Matters on the Community Radio Network. This week, we're speaking with Kate Harridan, Indigenous water expert at Monash Sustainable Development Institute. Kate has told us that Indigenous knowledge systems have been excluded in decision-making about water management in so-called Australia since colonisation. This absence has had a profound impact on country and Indigenous communities. I ask Kate to tell us more about what this has meant for First Nations people and the water itself.
The impacts to mob and country of Aqua Nullius are pretty severe, quite extensive, and as much as it hurts me to say, some of it's probably irredeemable. Like, it's just, some of it is just beyond repair now, the damage caused by Aqua Nullius. So there's a really fundamental Indigenous design principle for water, is that you don't build permanently on beds or banks. Now, that just sounds really sensible. And then you look at what happened at Lismore a couple of years ago, where anyone who was living on the floodplains was wiped out, because Western water hubris, Western hubris about water leads to really bad water policy. Because now we allow people, like Western culture allows people, to not only build on floodplains, but build on concrete pads on floodplains. You don't even have to build stilts. So You're doing all sorts of damage to the stream and the creek when you do this because a lot of things. First of all, it can't go through its own, as it's entitled and right to do as a living sentient entity, choose its own course. Choose where it goes high in high flows, choose where it goes low in dry season. You know, zones of connection between surface water and groundwater are now extinguished because of Western development and Western or settler state planning practices. I mean, whole streams and creeks don't exist on the surface of the country anymore because they're in concrete pipes, 2 meters or 1 meter below the surface. One of my favorite all-time trees in the whole wide world is the river is the Red River Gum on usually around the Murray. Beautiful, spectacular trees that have sustained country and people for millennia, dying, falling over. Like roots coming out of banks and collapsing because of the erosion that's coming underneath them because of artificially high and low flow regimes that happen very, very quickly. They're not in response to rainfall, they're in response or absence of rainfall, but in response to the opening or closing of a gate at a weir or a dam. They're really damaging things. I could go on. I feel like I've probably said too much, so I should stop now.
You also mentioned Australia has some big water problems. What, in your
Yes.
mind, are the key water problems that we're facing?
I'll probably sound like a broken record because I've said it already a couple of times in the last few minutes. But I actually think the fundamental problem is the ontology thing, is that non-Indigenous people see water first and foremost as a resource to be extracted for human benefit and financial gain. So, if I'm related to water, and I am because I'm a Wiradjuri person, I have to treat water like a grandmother, for example. I've never spoken to a non-Indigenous person who feels this way about water. And what non-Indigenous people, particularly engineers and people in the water sector, are happy to do is to put grandma in a straitjacket by armouring a creek with concrete, rocks in a box. Rocks in concrete. I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can armor a creek. You are essentially putting your grandmother in a straitjacket. And as First Nations people, we can't do that. That's disrespectful. It's that difference in mentality that drives the problems. I mean, sure, you could list problems. I mean, I think water quality is a pretty serious problem in this country. I think flow regimes is a very serious problem in this country. But those problems can't be solved in any meaningful or substantive way until those who control power and the actual literal flow of water see water as a grandmother or, you know, someone they love and care for and must respect. And I don't know about you all, but obey. My grandmothers were ferocious, loved them, and they spoiled me. But when your grandma told you to do something, you did it, didn't you? But I think that's the really big problem. Is that we just don't think the same about the role of water in I think about water in country. Non-Indigenous people think about water as a resource in land. Very different ways of approaching the same thing.
Must be very distressing to see the way in which colonization and this way of treating the waterways themselves and the spaces around them.
Yep.
When you
Yep,
talk
it can
about
make me
it,
cry. It can make me very sad. I can actually hear when I'm on my ancestral river, Murrumbidgee, I can hear it screaming in pain when the water is really low because it's all been sucked out by irrigators. You know, they've closed the wall up at Lake Hume and all the water's been sucked out by irrigators. And it makes me want to cry. And I don't need a hydrophone to hear river screaming. It just soul destroying.
The distress is not confined to impacts on country. Despite never having ceded their rights to water, First Peoples have been almost entirely excluded from water allocations and revenues under the colonial system. In Victoria, the situation was clearly documented in the Yuruk Justice Commission's Land, Sky and Waters hearings.
The Victorian government alone made a total revenue in 13 years of $83 billion from water. Mob who live on the Murray, who live in any of those catchments attached to any of those rivers that are in, present day Victoria, received $0. Now that's a pretty telling statistic. And traditional custodians across the Murray-Darling Basin have 0.2% of current entitlements. And for those who aren't aware, the current water allocation system, and I don't care whether you're looking at the Victorian system, the system attached to the Murray-Darling Basin, or in Queensland, every single water allocation system that settler state governments have established in Australia are currently over-allocated. So they're already allocating more water than is available in the system to everyone but First Nations peoples.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from around Australia, brought to you by the Community Radio Network. We're talking to Indigenous water expert, Wiradjuri woman Kate Harridan from the Monash Sustainable Development Institute. Kate's been talking about the gross inequity in revenue distribution and water allocation to traditional owners, particularly in Victoria. It's just one area of injustice in a water system founded on an absence of Indigenous rights known as aqua nullius. I want to come back to this absence and find out what Kate sees as the way forward.
I think if, as a nation state, we took more notice of Indigenous practices, I don't like to artificially divide between science or design or art or music. It's not the way mob generally flows. Oh, that was an unintended water pun. But yeah, it would be something. The design principles are quite simple, but really quite complex because, for example, the never building permanently on river banks or beds is so antithetical to the way we live now. But it's quite simple. You just don't put stuff there. But then what happens to things like in the society that we currently live? Bridges. So the footings of bridges end up having to be attached. So you have to, it's not as easy as being able to give, oh, we can do ABC. We have to actually really rethink what we're currently doing in terms of, Western engineering and how we can apply some of the really interesting technologies and practices that Western engineering can offer to the philosophy and principles of Indigenous design. But I think what would happen, broadly speaking, taking into account that, it's really hard to actually come up with any detailed stuff because of the complexity of the world in which we live. Broadly speaking, you would find if we were to adopt Indigenous design principles around waterways, rivers and streams and creeks that meander. Their flow courses will change. Sometimes they will change just temporarily. You might have a big flow, so the creek expands a bit, and then sometimes you might have a really major event and the creek might change course. That kind of stuff, which I find quite exciting, but I understand, puts fear into the heart of insurance actuaries and people like that. But that's the kind of thing that you would need to do. You'd need to be able to allow creeks and streams to choose their own course. And this is already being done. This is already being done in Western engineering concepts. So if you look at somewhere like Singapore, who've really quite run far ahead of Australia in terms of water sustainable urban design and are now looking at nature-based solutions, they have ripped up big main trunk channels of water, of stormwater infrastructure, and created parks that are essentially living streams, like proper living streams. So when it's not wet season or it's not very wet, it sits low in the middle of this nice green treed corridor. But when it's really wet, it can come up and fill up like it would have historically before the stormwater channel was in there. And all the infrastructure that's in there for the residents to use is essentially floodproof, so it can withstand periods of inundation, and then when the water flows away, it just needs a bit of a wash, a bit of a wipe down, and you're ready to use it again. So you have that kind of, there'd be real change in the way urban environments feel and move. I think you'd have much better water quality because you wouldn't be able to treat streams, creeks, and rivers as essentially pollutant highways like we currently do, particularly through stormwater systems. You have much greater biodiversity, and you'd be able to see really clearly, much more clearly, the interactions and the relationships that make country. I'm not aware if all your listeners know, but every stormwater channel and drain that you walk by is actually a creek or a stream. So I like to think of them all as creeks and streams. So if you walk along an armoured stream, which is a way another way of saying a stormwater channel, you will usually find maybe one species of tree, if you find any tree species at all. It's often like grass. And you may occasionally get a couple of birds going in and out of the tree. But if you had a riparian zone that was more like it was before it became a stormwater drain, a pollutant highway, there'd be different types of trees. You'd have different levels of story. You'd have of the floor, you'd have a upper story and a lower story and a mid story and all the ground covers. You'd have so many different types of animals. The water would be able to move between the ground and the surface so much more readily in a way that it's like supposed to do. So that means that those sites like aquifers and springs and chains of ponds that are supported by the movement of water through soil surface would continue to exist.
You're listening to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from around Australia, brought to you by the Community Radio Network. We're talking to Indigenous water expert, Wiradjuri woman Kate Harridan from the Monash Sustainable Development Institute.
First Nations water organisations or water groups would be wise to be developing water country plans. So they're setting the tone and the pace for what will happen on their country and how it will happen. So that what I just said there about water country plans li actually links into the second part of the Victorian Water Pathways document. Essentially, all of the First Nations groups in Victoria, whether they're a registered Aboriginal party or not, were invited to submit how they'd like the water system or the allocation system to go. And what was really interesting there was how many of the nation statements were deeply steeped in sovereign self-determination talk. And there was this big resistance to Aquinalius and some of the tactics that these nation statements included to resist Aquinalius were rather than having the catchment management authorities, it's a structure that's common, or in fact, probably unique to Victoria, the catchment management authorities. Instead of having catchment management authorities doing all the water stuff, give that authority and responsibility to us as the First Nations traditional, as the traditional custodians of this place. That's a very serious resistance to Aquinalius. And that's the kind of stuff we were talking about in the workshops a couple of years ago. And then I've also run with some non-Indigenous colleagues a similar series of workshops with public servants who work in the water policy and governance space in Commonwealth agencies and the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. So I'm working with both mob and non-Indigenous peoples. And it's interesting when non-Indigenous peoples begin to understand Aquinalius because it's not written down anywhere. It's not, no one's written in the Water Act or the Constitution of Australia, there be Aquinalius. But the non-Indigenous participants in these workshops, when they understood it, commented that they could no longer unsee it. Like everywhere they looked, they saw Aquinalius. Examples that we hadn't discussed, they could identify as Aquinalius. And to their credit, quite a few of them actually gone on and have challenged this a de facto policy in their workplace, and stuff has actually slowly, slowly, because it's the public service, has started to change.
We are almost out of time, but I have one final question for Kate. Are there messages for Australians in general about how we can think about water and how we can value and take care of it, even if we're not working in the water management space?
For me, though, I always come back to the small, personal, intimate gestures, Like, it doesn't have to be a big grand gesture. It can just be the way you go about your everyday. Maybe if you can't walk past that place where your dog loves to swim, maybe when you drive past it, you acknowledge it. Just go, oh, g'day, there's that place. I wonder how it's going today. You start engaging in a conversation with that place. It can be just very small, day-to-day, very private stuff. You could spend a week maybe walking along a different creek that you've never been to before and see the ways in which it's similar to or different from the creek that you know. Or I was just reading some bird pamphlets about birding in the ACT yesterday, and one of the things was for each of the birding areas that they listed the different bird, the key different birds that you were likely to find there. And each site, each of the birding sites had a different range of birds. That's the same with the river or creek or stream. You know, around one bend, you can have a different set of connections and relationships that you do on the bend that you're familiar with. So make an effort to get to familiar with the bend around, you know, the next bend around. The creek, or the river extends beyond its banks. So walk up that gentle little floodplain and see what trees, plants, or animals may be living 10 meters away from the actual running water. There's all that kind of stuff where you can build relationships with country in really informal ways. It does help if you can have those relationships while you're having a conversation with Indigenous friends about, well, what is country? What am I seeing? What am I feeling? How does it see or feel for you? And you'll notice when you start doing that, like, you'll become quite adept at picking up even small changes in flow height. Water looks different today. I wonder why. Then again, you're building these bigger, broader, expansive connections to country because you start thinking about the country upstream and the country downstream.
That's all we've got time for this week. A big thanks to Kate Harridan for sharing her knowledge and time with us, as well as the sound recordings you heard throughout the episode. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Radio Network for broadcasting this program around the country and the Community Radio Foundation for their generous financial support. Join us next week for another episode of Earth Matters.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is ours.
Disasters like flood, fire, and extreme heat can have a significant impact on people's lives. Community legal centres help people experiencing challenges posed by climate change and disasters to access the resources and support they need. Disasters can lead to a range of problems, such as damage to your home, poor conditions with your rental home, difficulty getting insurance, issues within families, at work, and with Centrelink payments. Community legal centres can be found across Victoria and can provide help if you've been affected by a disaster. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres website at fclc.org.au. You can also contact Disaster Legal Help Victoria on 1800 113 432 and go to its website for helpful information at disasterlegalhelp.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter. Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Friends of the Earth Food Co-op is open. Get fresh produce and support local farmers and keep our grassroots community thriving through these unusual times. Organic veggie boxes and click and collect now available. Visit www.foefood.org/click-collect to place your orders. Or pop in store at 312 Smith Street and see how we're adapting with our new physical distancing layout. Shop organic and buy local. Made easy at Friends of the Earth. A proud 3CR supporter.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.